House Resources Committee to order. The time is 1:23 p.m. Members present at this time, Representative Chris Tuck, Representative Sarah Hannon, Representative Dave Tellerico, Representative Sarah Rasmussen, Vice Chair Representative Greyer Hopkins, Co-Chair Representative John Lincoln, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to do business. Assisting us today is Brett Collins from as the LIO moderator. Thank you very much. And Ms. Tillinghast, thank you so much, as our recording secretary. We have two items on the agenda today. The first is HJR 25, Ensure Access into Denali Park by Representative Tellerico and Josephson. And then we have the presentations from the Food Coalition folks, the Food Security Week. Very excited to have all of you here. Welcome. So the first item of business is HJR 25. And Representative Tellerico, you're going to go to the front.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate this opportunity. I'm Dave Tellerico. I represent House District 6, which is a really big portion of the eastern interior of Alaska, and actually comes all the way out to the center of Alaska. So. I always like to describe it for folks. It goes from Tanana to Arctic Village to Eagle, down to Northway, down to Chitna, and up around Fairbanks. And if I had another spot of the Denali Highway, I would surround Representative Hopkins and the rest of the people in the interior. But it's a very unique district, Madam Chair. And I got a message to both chairs that I was hoping that Representative Josephson could join me today, but I do believe that he is right now chairing his own finance subcommittee. So, we were hoping he wanted to add his support to this as well, and I certainly would welcome him if he comes in. I would ask that we could welcome him to a chair. House Joint Resolution 25, I know that you're all aware, and you probably saw the news, there's an issue on the road that goes through Denali National Park. It's out at mile 45.4, the area that most people refer to as Polychrome Pass, where the road climbs up and goes along a rocky outcrop mountainside and goes all the way up to Polychrome Pass and then drops into the rest of the park. The road's been moving for a while, for quite a few years. There's been I wouldn't call it a significant failure, but there's been some activity on the road. Where I used to work in my previous career, we used to just refer to that as a slump. There's a slump in the road. It's been cracking and moving along. It's certainly gotten more significant in the last few years. And I know you all have my sponsor statement, and a lot of times people just blow right through the sponsor statement. I'll just hit the high points for you. The road, I know many of you have probably been in the park and been on the road. The road's 92 miles long, goes all the way to Kantishna, and it's really the only route into Kantishna, back in the Kantishna area. There are several private businesses back there that provide probably a unique experience for visitors in the park. Those that want to go back and visit actually have the opportunity to stay back in Kantishna, so there are several private businesses back there. Also, one of a large campground in the park is Wonder Lake Campground, which is maintained by Denali National Park. It's a pretty special place back there for sure. So keeping the access road into Denali National Park is critical for residents, particularly people in the Kantishna area, and visitors alike. The park generally has about, I think the last couple of years, they've cracked the 600,000 mark for visitors that go back into the park. I really don't know how many go back past Polychrome Pass, but I do know something that you've heard of, the Eielson Visitor Center is located beyond this problem. And the Eielson Visitor Center is one of the most popular destinations that Denali has. Most folks really don't go all the way back to Wonder Lake, but the Eielson Visitor mm-hmm. Center certainly is a major attraction. So the importance of the road, I think, and the real significance here is, and I've had an opportunity to talk to many people. At one point in time in a previous life, I actually was part of the visitor industry and owned and operated a small overnight accommodations facility just outside of the park entrance. Most of a really large portion of our travelers have Denali National Park as a part of their itinerary. It's a kind of a key component to a lot of folks that come up, I think. You know, they may come up, they can come up on a cruise line, they can come up on an airplane, they may drive up the Alaska Highway. But a lot of these itineraries, Denali is a portion of the itinerary. A lot of cruise people that come through Juneau will travel on up, get into Anchorage, go up the Parks Highway, go through Denali, go up to Fairbanks. I have a friend that runs a business actually up in Fort Yukon, and he had concerns about the park road because a reasonable portion of the people that he serves every summer actually have Denali National Park as part of their itinerary. So the idea for the visitor industry and the critical step here is Denali National Park is such a big part of all of this that the worry was when they said, well, we might have to close the park road. Well, we don't. And I couldn't even guess to predict what the impact might be on people booking trips up here. But for a lot of these trips, Denali National Park is kind of the absolute high point of this of the visitation. They really want to be in Denali, and they really want to see it. There's a couple other things, though, that are also included in that park road, and I'm sure you're all familiar with the park road lottery. They have a lottery every year that you can apply for the lottery. There's almost strictly Alaska residents. They apply for the lottery, and the park opens up, and you have the opportunity to drive as far back on the park road as you want for 4 days. Lots of people enjoy that. I don't live far from the park, so I see these throngs of people that come down. They've gotten their lottery opportunity. A lot of folks, of course, usually it's families. A lot of people like to take their kids in there. There's a lot to see and everything. So the lottery is always full. There's never a shortage of applicants for the lottery. I would know that. I would assume there's never a shortage of applicants for the lottery because I've applied for the lottery 17 times in a row and have not gotten a lottery. So
part of that club.
Yeah. Part of that. Some people are part of that club. I don't think I'm on a special list to not get a lottery. I just think there are more applicants than there are spots available. So I think it's pretty important to the folks, and particularly the residents in Alaska, to have the opportunity to do that. The Park Service also has another kind of a unique thing where they our active military have an opportunity in the fall, and they open it up for no park fees for them to come into Denali National Park because there's a fee to come into the park. The park offers that for active military. They've been doing that for quite a while, so our active military personnel can come down. And we do have military installations that are close, Clear Air Force Station being the closest. But we have people come down from Fort Wainwright, and we have people come down from Eielson Air Force Base. They come over from Greeley, and they come up from J-Bear as well because it's an opportunity actually to express appreciation to those people that serve in our military that are in uniform, and they get an opportunity to come up and do that. So really, the gist behind this resolution is encouragement from the Alaska State Legislature that we recognize the importance of the park road, we recognize the importance of our visitor industry, and we also recognize the importance for our own residents and our uniformed military personnel to have the opportunity to go in there. And we will this resolution will be forwarded on to our congressional delegation, and quite honestly, for them to get resolved to this, and not just the temporary fix as well, but I think it's important they look into the long-term planning. Now the Park Service has begun to do that process. I've heard of several different plans that they would do, but I would just appreciate your support of this resolution so that we can show our support to our industry. This would have a negative economic impact, and I don't think it's just Denali. I think the negative economic impact would be statewide. Mm-hmm. And it also, if they can get this resolved, will also serve those other purposes that I spoke about. So, Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'm available for questions. Sometimes I know I talk so much that no one wants to ask me a question.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. That was a very excellent presentation and makes me excited to go to Denali this summer. Any questions for the resolution sponsor? Representative Hopkins.
No questions, but I certainly wanted to thank Representative Tallarico for bringing this forward. I probably managed to snag your park lottery tickets because I've been 5 or 6 times myself. And I enjoyed every time, even when we're snowed out at Bodychrome Pass. But thank you for that spot. You know, this is something that the Fairbanks North Star Borough has been pushing for, is to keep this road open and as far in as we can throughout the winter as well. This is a hefty winter tourism draw, and maintaining the park. This, as he said, Polychrome Pass is 45 miles in, where the slide is currently blocking the road. But keeping the park road open to mile 30 throughout the winter to Savage Creek allows a lot of recreation and a lot of tourism to be able to go down there. And we all know winter tourism in Fairbanks is a growing area of progress and tourism dollars for our local industry. So we want to make sure people get above Anchorage when they come and visit us and come north, and getting them to Denali is a step in the right direction. And for everyone's information here, May is the month that you enter the road lottery. You do it through the National Park Service, and it is about in the middle of September, which I'm told is the safest time for any representatives to be planning a trip, because that's hunting season. We never have special session then. So thank you very much again for bringing this forward. And if I win again, I promise I'll take you.
All right. He said it on the record, too. Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. Through the chair, and I just have a comment. I'm supportive of this, obviously, and I wanted to underscore a point that you made earlier. You said that a lot of tourists come to Denali, and I just crunched the numbers. And there's in 2017, there was 1.93, almost 2 billion, 1.93 million tourists that came to Alaska, and of those, 30% fully went to Denali. It is a crown jewel, and I remember, you know, going to Denali as a child, camping. My mom and godmom would take us there every single year, and we would camp rain or shine, mostly rain, because, you know, it was August in Alaska, and we met people from all over the world. And I was always so proud to meet people from Germany or France or South America, you know, from Russia, wherever they were coming from. That they would come to Denali, they would come to Alaska. I think it's a special place that we should preserve that. And then when I think about, you know, the economic diversification, I think Denali is a really sort of key linchpin to further expanding tourism. You know, I always say that Alaska's most precious natural resource are Alaskans. I think our second most precious natural resource is our environment, and that over the long term, that's going to be the thing that we can capitalize on year in and year out. After oil is gone, Denali will still be here, right? In fact, it might be a little bit closer to the ocean's edge by then, too. So I think it's an opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And like the others on the committee, thank you for bringing the resolution. I'll be in support of it. The lottery tip I would give you, because I've never prevailed, but you put everybody's name in because it's one per vehicle. You then find out that every 15-passenger van in Fairbanks is rented out for lottery weekend, because in 2017, when we put in 12 applications, got one permit, the problem was to find a vehicle that would accommodate the family, because nobody in the family drove a 12-passenger vehicle, but now we had everybody put their name in. But you could find them, and hundreds of Alaskans. I think I ran into 15 other Juneau groups while on the road the day we were there, and it's an incredible opportunity for Alaskans in our finest, with or without snow.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to take away from time from our testifiers. I'm sure they want to share their stories as well. I used to go in and out of Denali National Park prior to the lottery days. They used to be able to, at the end of September, allow you to go in for a week. Mm-hmm. And the last part of it was you can drive back with your own vehicles. And I had a vehicle with a sunroof in it. The timing belt went out. We broke down and back in there. And towing my vehicle on the way out, we saw the most amazing light show ever, to where I had to lay on the horn and pull over, because we were looking out the sunroof and looking out the windows because of the amazing northern lights combined with meteor showers. They were going on simultaneously. Wow. And so we pulled over both vehicles, one in tow and everything. We all got out, and we just laid on the bank and just was in amazement. And then following years after that, the park rangers would always say, okay, when you guys going to leave? Because we're not locking up. You guys can go, because we were always the last ones there. And it was usually when the first snowfall hits, and that's when they tell you, we have to kick you out now the snow's flying. But wonderful experience. The lottery just shows that there is a big demand to go in there. That road is vital for people's experiences, even for expanding the opportunities there at Denali National Park. So thank you for the resolution.
Denali is special to all of us, apparently, right? Any other questions or comments from committee members?
Madam Chair, I will confess that I had the ability to ride a Hodaka 125 all the way back to Wonder Lake. And evidently, what I've suddenly realized, I am the oldest member of the Resource Committee. And that was at a time when you could drive all the way back anytime you wanted to. Wow. I did that in July.
Wow.
That's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to tell you what year I was born. Thank you. It's still, even to this day, with the transportation system that they've set up, it's an incredible experience.
Thank you so much, Representative Tallarico. We're going to go next to invited testimony, and we have Don Stryker, the superintendent from Denali National Park, online. Mr. Stryker?
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As you said, my name is Don Stryker, and I'm the superintendent for the last 7 years of Denali National Park and Preserve, and currently I'm acting as the regional director for the National Park Service in Alaska. I just wanted to call in and thank you and offer my support for this joint resolution. I can't be more articulate, I think, than Representative Tallarico was, so thank you, sir, for that excellent introduction. I can tell you that you're not on any list that I've seen, too. Well, maybe we should start making a list based on the intel that you're getting there in committee, huh? I'd just like to reinforce that we in the National Park Service recognize the importance of outdoor recreation to Alaska and to Alaskans. You know, tourism is a major economic driver. It might be the biggest part of our economy these days. Alaska, I can tell you, is the number one destination for America's first-time cruisers, right? And this first-time cruise market is incredibly important, because ship passengers tend to be really brand loyal. And a tour of the Denali Park Road, along with a cruise into Glacier Bay National Park, are really the crown jewels in terms of destinations for Alaskan visitors. As you said, we're enjoying currently over 600,000 visits each year, and the trend has been upward in the last decade. Just a little bit of spending data, these visitors generate more than $600 million in direct spending and are responsible for 8,150 jobs statewide. When you crunch the numbers, that's nearly $1 billion in total economic output for Alaska, roughly half of the economic contribution of the entire national park system in Alaska. We understand these dynamics, and we take very, very seriously our responsibility to be good neighbors by ensuring access to Denali, both as a primary attraction and also Denali's responsibility for setting the hook for the people who come to Denali so that they'll want to return to Alaska and visit all of the other awesome places that we have to offer. And so because of that, I just wanted to express how much I appreciate the direction that you're articulating in HJR 25. And I want to tell you how much I appreciate the support that you can bring through this resolution by underscoring just how critical our state, federal, and our public-private partnerships are to ensuring that access to Denali is available for our visiting public. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stryker. We appreciate your testimony. Any questions from committee members? Okay, seeing none, we appreciate you, and we hope that we all end up on some good list to get a lottery soon. We will then go to the public testimony, and we have a few folks here online. I'll first go to Sarah Leonard from the Alaska Travel Industry Association. Ms. Leonard?
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sarah Leonard. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Travel Industry Association, and I also appreciate the many comments and support and stories of what is really one of the jewels of the Alaska visitor system, Alaska visitor industry, and also the national park system. The 680 members of ATIA and businesses that directly and indirectly depend on safe efficient access into Denali National Park support this resolution. Alaska's national parks are experiencing, unfortunately, a growing backlog of maintenance needs. Half of Denali National Park's $54 million in deferred maintenance projects is due to deteriorating conditions along the park road. Without this safe and reliable access into the park, as many of you have expressed, would create significant economic impact throughout Alaska's visitor industry. I also appreciate the comments from Don Stryker and others that relate to how tourism contributes to Alaska's economy and how national parks, including Denali National Park, are critical to that success. More than or almost 600,000 visitors came to Denali, generating more than $600 million in visitor spending, and you heard total economic output close to $1 billion for the state. If the Denali Park Road were to close for an extended period, hotels, tour operators, restaurants, and businesses would experience severe economic impacts that would ripple across the state. You also heard that this impacts really a broad range of our industry, from large cruise businesses that offer extended land excursions to small operators who provide seasonal visitor services at the park. ATI supports the efforts of the National Park Service, our partners there, and this legislature for your support in a process that ensures a safe, reliable, and timely opening of the park road this summer, as well as efforts toward a long-term solution. We also recognize the fact that significant resources are needed to accomplish both this immediate and long-term solutions, and we thank you for supporting this resolution to move that process forward. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Ms. Leonard. We appreciate your testimony. Any questions for the testifier? Okay, seeing none, we will go next to Clay Walker, the Denali Borough Mayor. Mayor Walker?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I am Mayor Clay Walker, serving the Denali Borough, and yes, following in the large footsteps of Representative Tallarico in this position. And thank you for Representative Tallarico. Thank you for your leadership on this issue, and thanks to the committee for hearing this. And I'm calling, of course, in support of HJR number 25. The Denali Borough Assembly actually is considering a similar resolution at their meeting tonight. For the importance of the Denali Park Road to the economy of the state and the Denali Borough simply cannot be overstated. Road accessibility into the Denali wilderness is what sets it apart. And personally, I did have the pleasure of professionally guiding on that road for over 20 years. I know it intimately when I came around that corner on Polychrome in 1992 on my first training run. The trainer said, "Here comes the whoop-de-doo." And, well, the whoop-de-doo's gotten a lot worse these days over the years. And, you know, as borough mayor, I've been talking about it, with our federal delegation for a couple years now, supporting the deferred maintenance bill. You know, I do like to call the Denali Park Road the longest road in the borough. We do have about 80 miles of the park's highway coming through. But those 92 miles of the park Denali Park Road are absolutely vital access to those businesses in Kantishna, and the destinations that would be, you know, cut off by a closure at mile 43, Toklat, Stony Hill, Eielson Visitor Center, Wonder Lake, Kantishna. These are premier destinations. And yeah, the visitor industry is a shining light in our economy, and the Denali Borough is happy to be in the heat of that white light. And at the same time, we all need to work together, federal, state, and local, to support this vital piece of infrastructure. You know, it's Alaskan infrastructure. So I'm so pleased to see the state supporting this, and I look forward to bringing forward this united message of support for this, again, vital piece of Alaskan infrastructure. Thank you, and we look forward to seeing you here.
Thank you so much, Mayor Walker. Any questions for the mayor? Representative Tallarico.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. Mayor Walker, thanks so much for the support and for working with the Assembly on that, and thanks for the job you do.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. We appreciate your work there in Juneau.
Wonderful. Seeing no other questions, we'll go to our last testifier I have here online, Jenna Hamm, the co-owner of Camp Denali and North Face Lodge. Ms. Hamm?
Hello, Madam Chair. My name is Jenna Hamm. I, with my husband, operate Camp Denali and North Face Lodge at the end of the road in the Kentishna. We are one of four businesses that own and operate lodges at the very end of the road, which, of course, relies on that access. But I'd love to echo what other people have said, thanking Representative Tallarico and co-sponsors, Josephson and Hopkins, for presenting this resolution. And I really appreciate legislators' engagement on this issue, which, as Sarah Leonard said, is really critical to sustaining the tourism economy at both the local and the state level. I would propose, if I may, to the committee, the addition of 2 points to consider. One of those is that, as I stated earlier, to highlight the fact that there are 4 businesses that provide a unique experience to park visitors at the end of the road in Kentishna that rely on that access. And more specific to that access, that the Kentishna businesses there do have a right under ANILCA Section 1110B to reasonable access for economic purposes. And that access has been historically along the Denali Park Road itself. Air access has not really been a part of that picture for any of the infrastructure that has developed out at the end of the road over time. So I'd emphasize those 2 points, and also that legislators be aware of any opportunities for partnership between the National Park Service and the state. Definitely an opportunity to extend some resources and expertise to help the National Park Service with this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hamm. We appreciate your testimony. Any questions for the testifier? Yes, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I heard correctly, that there's 4 businesses that rely on that road for their business, and those are all Kentishna owned businesses, is that correct?
There are 4 businesses. Ours is one. We own and operate 2 lodges, Camp Denali and North Face Lodge. Camp Denali, of course, was begun by 2 Alaska pioneers, Jenny Wood and Celia Hunter, and Jenny's husband, Morton Wood, back in 1952. And it's been in operation since that time for a full 2/3 of the park's history. There are 3 other entities a little further down the road. We're at mile 89. The other 3 lodges are the Kentishna Roadhouse, which is owned by Doyon Incorporated. Kentishna Air Taxi owns an accommodation called Skyline Lodge, which runs an accommodation, small accommodation, and then operates the air taxi at the end of the road. And then Denali Backcountry Lodge is the other full-service accommodation in the valley.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions for the testifier? Representative Lincoln has a question.
Thank you. Could you restate what was the section of ANILCA you referenced in terms of guaranteed access?
That is section 1110B, 110B.
Okay. Thank you.
Has to do with rights of reasonable access for economic and other purposes.
Thank you, Ms. Hamm. I appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on this resolution? Okay, seeing no one else online and no one in the room, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. I'm going to take a brief at ease. I think at this time there's enough comfort with the resolution as drafted from committee members that we want to move it forward. Ms. Hamm, just want to make note that your comments are being taken into consideration, and there's another opportunity for implementing or including in the resolution beyond the Resources Committee. So at this time, is there any committee discussion? Okay, then I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move HDR 25 version 31-LS1472/M from committee with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, House Joint Resolution 25 moves from committee. And seeing that we're a little bit pressed for time, I'm just going to roll right into our next presentation. and we can send the paperwork around as we're kind of transitioning the second half here, and we will be able to run a few minutes over. The Labor and Commerce Committee starts at 3:15, so we should try to be done by 3:10. So we have a couple of extra minutes here, and so let me go back to my notes as to who is going to go first today so that I can have you come up here. So I think first we're going to have Rachel Miller come up. Rachel is a constituent, which is very cool for me, and is also the co-chair of the Alaska Food Policy Council. And I think she's going to start our introduction. Welcome. And if you wouldn't mind, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Sure. Rachel Miller, co-chair of the Alaska Food Policy Council. Sorry for the screen, it's a digital age, digital notes. So thank you, committee co-chairs, Tar and Lincoln, and members of the committee for your time today. I am honored to be here for Food Security Week, and I'm hopeful that food access continues to be an issue that is at the forefront of everyone's minds and incorporated into policy work. Food is truly a transdisciplinary cause, from emergency and disaster preparedness to economic development to ensuring that our most vulnerable populations are taken care of completely. So I'm Rachel Miller, co-chair of the Alaska Food Policy Council. I am a business professor at Alaska Pacific University and the manager of APU's 800-acre Kellogg Farm Campus in Palmer. This is my first rodeo in Juneau, and the past few days have been really heartening. The phrase that I've heard the most from legislators is, "What do you need and how can we help?" That's fantastic. I don't think you would get that in every state. So thank you for your support, and at the Alaska Food Policy Council, we look forward to continued discussion and doing and collaborating together. Food is a wonderfully bipartisan issue. Everyone needs it. It's not going to run. We're not going to stop needing it. But the breakdown in implementing food policy and building a more resilient food system is often in the how to implement policy, how to increase access. The Alaska Food Coalition chose to focus this year's Food Security Week on production, waste, and access. So I'm here to set the stage for a few of our other experts today, who will talk more about the how of the execution of what we're asking for. And I'm your hype girl. I'm here to get excited about food systems. So at AFPC, we connect, we inform, and we advocate. Some of our recent projects include working with the municipality of Anchorage to implement a mini grants program to give some seed funding at a small level to people who want to do food projects around the city. That's something we would love to increase around the state. We've also commissioned two key reports highlighting opportunities for food infrastructure investment, one from 2014 and 2018, so fairly recent. We also are hosting our fifth or sixth upcoming Alaska Food Conference and Festival. It is at UAA in Anchorage this year in November, and we would love to see everyone here there. You are all invited and welcome. And it's where hundreds of people literally from across the state gather to share what's happening about food in their areas. So it's neat. So at AFPC, it's safe to say that we're excited about food systems, but we need to back up a little bit and talk about why we're here. What is a food system and what is food security? Most of us think of a food system as the linear supply chain, production to end waste. It is so much more. It is culture, it is language, it is family, and it's mostly about choice. There are over 200 definitions of food security in the world, but for us, we think it just means enough. Enough to eat, enough to share, and enough to rest easy. Most people shy away from food security work because it's hard. It's difficult, it's sad, and it's a long play. So if you're in that camp, we can change course. Let's talk about something exciting. Why is it exciting to work in food in Alaska? From the AFPC reports that we commissioned, we had some really key findings. We know, and it's been bandied about a lot, that we import 95 to 98% of our food. We are highly food insecure from an import perspective. We know that $2 billion leaves the state in food purchasing every year. Even a fraction of that staying in the state would have a pretty large local economic impact. But we also know that direct-to-consumer sales are increasing. Alaskans continue to ask for Alaskan goods. I used to live in Colorado and thought they were a very proud people until I moved to Alaska. We love us, some Alaskans. We also found in these reports that there are opportunities for distributed infrastructure for food processing, production, and storage. And really, there are other opportunities to decrease barriers for food startups. We also know from the 2017 Ag Census that Alaska is leading the nation in new farmers. We are leading the nation in female farmers. We know that farming looks different up here. It looks like somebody with a half-acre backyard. It does not look like Iowa, and so we need to treat ag policy as such and differentiate ourselves. So I'm an entrepreneurship professor and a recovering food entrepreneur. I've launched a couple of food businesses. It is a tough row to hoe, pun intended. I believe in responsible business as a solution for community empowerment and long-lasting food resiliency. In Alaska, we do live a little bit closer to the land by default. Look outside today. And I think we exercise triple bottom line philosophy where we can appear, almost by default. And that means valuing social, ecological, and economic or financial bottom line. Food work lends itself very nicely to triple bottom line impact. Supporting our food system means we really can do well by doing good up here. So what does a triple bottom line approach look like? That's what our speakers are going to talk about today. So I ask you to consider people, planet, and profit when you're looking at food policy. We can better support the people in our food system, decrease our carbon footprint, or our food print, if you will, and bolster our local economies. Supporting farmers through land access programs and allowing farmers to cover their interns and volunteers under their workers' comp policies, which is currently not allowed, will reduce barriers for those wanting to grow food and expand. Building our ag labor pipeline is good for the economy, and it's good for hyper-local food policy. Continuing to support indigenous food programs, like we see at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage, where Chef Amy Foote has been on a crusade to offer our elders the foods they grew up on, because after all, food is not just about the commodity trade, it is a cultural cornerstone of every people's existence. Supporting policy for herd share programs is a great way to rebuild our industry in a modern way and help producers create value add products that have higher margins. Again, smart for business, smart for local economy. Let's fully embrace the division of agriculture to continue helping food businesses grow, thrive, and if they so desire, achieve the holy grail of Alaska business, which is export, which we're just whispering at this stage. And the Division of Ag has been a key player in helping businesses like the Alaska Flour Company expand across the state. It is critical to support reliable and affordable transportation systems around the state. They ensure critical last mile distribution of food aid, but they also help food entrepreneurs access that last mile of market access. So helping food businesses thrive. And of course, for all of this wonderful economic opportunity, again, recovering food entrepreneur, we must not forget to consider those most in need. And we ask you to consider the implications for policies, such as the ABOD time limit that we talked about at length this week, as well as cuts to senior benefits and other similar policies. At a very basic level, we must do better by our elders and by our children. This is where it gets cool. I really think Alaska has the opportunity to model food systems resilience for other countries in the circumpolar north and around the world. I worked in West Africa for several years and saw many similarities with broken supply chains, problems with energy storage, broken grids, definitely lack of cold storage. We're seeing the same things here. Climate change, refugees, it's happening on our land up here. And if we can do it here, if we can make food systems work here, we can probably do it on Mars. So with creative energy projects happening around the state, we're seeing the number of hydroponic projects explode. This isn't just good for year-round produce production. It's an exciting training path for the leaders of tomorrow, our future engineers, our future wastewater plant managers. Everybody can learn through the lens of food. So if we are truly open for business in Alaska, let's invest here first. Keep going with the tremendous momentum that we have seen since 2012 especially. Alaska is an ag state. And I wonder what we could be if we invested in land-based ag as we have in Alaska seafood. So thank you for your time and attention today. Thank you for supporting Food Security Week in our capital. I hope we continue to do this. I hope we all see you in November at UAA at our conference. You are all invited. Thank you for your time. I invite the next speaker.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Excellent presentation. Any questions? You may have questions before you go. Any questions for Ms. Miller before she goes? Okay, no, you're off the hot seat. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to invite up Jenny DeGrappa and Kara Durr from the Alaska Food Coalition, and they're going to talk about improving food access. I didn't see her. And it looks like maybe just Kara is with us right now. Okay.
Jenny had to hop on a flight, so unfortunately she wasn't able to be here. But thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for having me as part of this presentation. My name is Kara Durr. I am the Director of Public Engagement for the Food Bank of Alaska. I am also a governing board member of the Alaska Food Policy Council. And I'm here to just, I think, frame a little bit of the access piece. I know this is probably not the purview of this committee as much, but I think it really ties into a lot of what Rachel was saying. Sorry, can you better now? Okay. I think it ties in really well with what Rachel is saying, how, you know, we have come here as many different entities representing different parts of the food system and really are trying to look at it, you know, from the production to the access to the waste piece. And so I thought I would just share a little bit about some of the opportunities that we at Food Bank of Alaska and our partners in the Alaska Food Coalition see to support some of those other areas, particularly the production piece. So the first thing I wanted to share a little bit about is a program that we've recently launched out in the Bethel region, which is produce boxes. And so where this came from was a grant from Morgan Stanley, and it was to buy up excess produce. And so we were able to reach out to some of our farming partners and found that Myers Farm actually had a large quantity of food that they were planning to use in food boxes, but I think their funding source had fallen through to subsidize some of this. So we were able to step in there. We were also able to work with, the Anchor Point Farm and the Ridgeway Farm in Kenai, and those were slightly smaller programs. But the produce box program out of Bethel with Myers Farm, I think, was a really great project. So what that grant funding enabled us to do was to subsidize the boxes that were coming out of Myers Farm, so low-income Alaskans could access that produce. And, you know, we all know how expensive produce can be in many of the rural areas. And we just heard from participants that it was a really wonderful program, and they were just so thrilled to have that really fresh produce. So that was something we saw that really as a win-win. You know, it was a win for the farms that we were able to help support, and of course it was a win for the low-income clients around the state that don't always have access to this great food. So, you know, again, we're just keeping in mind, you know, we want to ramp up production, and I think that long-term will have really positive effects for our state. But, you know, thinking creatively of how we can help get this amazing food to people that really need it and want to buy it but can't always afford it. And so through that program, we were able to send out about 35,000 pounds of produce. It went to 1,900 boxes and to 45 different communities in the YK Delta. So that was exciting. Another program I wanted to briefly touch on, because I think this is also pretty exciting, and we've had lots of conversations with many different stakeholders in this, is really looking at this concept of, you know, how can we increase purchasing power for low-income Alaskans for produce. There's a federal grant. It's called the Gus Schumacher Nutrition Incentive Grant, formerly the FINNY grant. Some people might be familiar with that, the Food Insecurity and Nutrition Incentive. And what it does is it's a federal grant that allows you to basically have double bucks for produce for SNAP recipients. So this could be at grocery stores. This could be at farmers markets. And so there's different mechanisms you can do, but the model we've been looking at, which is what Washington State has, is anytime a SNAP recipient goes to a grocery store or a farmer's market and they spend a minimum threshold of, I think it's $10 in Washington, they then get a bonus coupon for their next visit. And the results coming out of Washington were really encouraging, because it was showing that SNAP recipients were purchasing more produce than they needed initially to get the voucher, and then when they were returning, they were also purchasing more. So I think it was really showing that it was helping to change consumption patterns, because we know, you know, low-income people often want to buy better food, but, you know, cheap and processed food is often what's cheap and what's going to be filling for your family. So we've had kind of a small informal coalition of groups that have really been looking at that grant. We're not sure if we're going to apply this year because there is a 100% match requirement, which is tough. And, you know, we
are trying to be sensitive to not start a program that's not sustainable, that might go away, because that's obviously really hard. But I think this concept, you know, and many of you will be familiar about the double bucks at farmers markets that we used to have and the state used to support, and that was really just a beloved program. And again, it's that win-win of supporting our local farmers, but also giving, you know, access to low-income Alaskans to this food. So just wanted to share these two projects, these two potential ideas, just as I think some areas of opportunity for us to continue to think about and want you guys as members of the legislature to think about as well.
Thank you so much, Ms. Durr. Any questions for Ms. Durr? I was just going to ask, in the Lunch and Learn, you were talking a little bit about how even though the food bank is located in Anchorage, that it has a much more of a statewide impact. Mm-hmm. And because there's people from, you know, around the state, I just thought that might be helpful if you talk a little bit about how, you know, it anchors and helps the other surrounding communities.
Yeah, so Food Bank of Alaska doesn't distribute directly to individuals. We work through our partners. We have about 150 partners statewide. And we are, you know, kind of charged with this state. We work very closely with our sister food banks that we've got in Kenai, Juneau, and Fairbanks, and then they're serving their regions. And I think Fairbanks has a little bit wider of a purview. They're doing some around the state too. But you know, we all work together to get food where it needs to go.
Thank you, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Durr, you mentioned Myers Farm, and I am unfamiliar with who they are and where they are, so if you could share that with me. Yeah. And then I have one other question.
Okay, yeah, so Myers Farm is a farm out in Bethel, and Tim Myers runs it, and he's doing really, really awesome things there. Is using some really innovative technology where he's kind of using, digging down into making root cellars, and has discovered that there's just some really amazingly fertile land out there, and really looking, I think, to scale up what he's doing and looking for markets. I know at one point he had an agreement where he was actually backhauling produce to Anchorage, and he said, I can get produce to Anchorage cheaper than they can from the valley. So I think it's a great opportunity, and just trying to think about more ways he can get that out.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, that actually led to mine, because I think that farm is the Fairbanks family's farm. Some members of the Fairbanks family were involved with it, and I was wondering if any of those rural farms that we know are in operation were able to be participants in the produce boxes. So I'm thrilled to hear that.
Excellent. Any other questions for Ms. Durr? Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for your time.
Next, we have Suzanne Caldwell, the recycling coordinator from Solid Waste Services for the Municipality of Anchorage. And then is Andrew also? All right, Andrew Mergens, I hope I'm saying that right, from the Anchorage School District. And they're going to talk about a pilot program to reduce waste and then use of Alaska-grown food in schools.
Hello, thank you so much for having me today. My name is Susanna Caldwell. I'm the recycling coordinator at Solid Waste Services for the Municipality of Anchorage. I'm really excited to talk to you today about the organics recycling program that we've been developing in Anchorage, and talk a little bit of all the trash that we have. We're talking about food security and food and all of that, and really, you know, another part of it is thinking about the end of the life of all of this material. And right now, most of the food, when we're done eating it, we just throw it away, and it ends up going into the landfill. So I'm really excited to talk to you about some of the work that we're doing to keep it out of the landfill and to promote food security in South Central Alaska. So just really briefly, at Solid Waste Services, we operate the Anchorage Regional Landfill. It's the final disposal site for all trash that's generated within the municipality. We take in about 300,000 tons of trash every year. It works out to about 1,200 tons a day. And if you're familiar with the BP building in Midtown Anchorage, we take in enough trash every month to fill that building. So it's a tremendous amount of trash that we're seeing every day. And so since we are the operators of the landfill, we have a commitment to try to keep it open as long as possible. Landfills are not infinite resources. Ours will close. Right now, the estimated closure date is 2063. it's about 40 years out. That's a long time, but it's within my lifetime. And if our landfill closes, we don't have any other options for a landfill in the Anchorage area. There's no spot that's big enough to contain another one. We'd have to look at shipping our trash out of state or to other regions of the state. It'd be tremendously expensive. And so we are really committed to keeping this resource open for as long as possible to everyone. So what's the best way to do that? Recycling, trying to keep stuff out of the landfill in the first place. Right now, we do have commodities recycling, so paper, plastic, that sort of thing. But we're really beholden to outside forces. Most of the commodities recycling that we have ends up getting shipped down to the lower 48. So we are totally at the whims of international and domestic markets related to that. So at Solid Waste Services, we're always looking at ways that we can keep stuff local. And so organics is one of the great things that we found that we can actually keep local and do something with and not fill up our landfill. So why organics? Why would we target this in the first place? Well, according to the EPA, about 25% of all residential solid waste is made up of organic material. And when I talk about organics, I'm talking about food scraps, and I'm also talking about yard debris, so like leaves and grass and twigs and stuff like that. We estimate that if we were able to establish a really robust curbside collection program for organics, we could potentially remove up to 50,000 tons of material out of the waste stream every year. If we were able to start targeting institutions and restaurants and businesses, we could get another 40,000 tons out of that collection. So really there is a tremendous amount of material that we could potentially pull out of the waste stream and use for beneficial purposes. I would also add, this is a recommended item in both the Solid Waste Services Master Plan and the Climate Action Plan that we passed last year. There are a lot of environmental benefits to getting organics out of the waste stream. When you put organic material into a landfill, it decomposes anaerobically and creates methane. Methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. Right now we have a robust collection system that collects it, and we send a lot of that gas to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson to power about 25% of the base's overall power load, but we still end up flaring between a quarter to a third of all the gas that we're producing on any given day. So we don't need to produce more gas. We need to get it out. Also, when we're able to compost it, obviously we can create compost that can go back into our food system and allow us to grow more food and to have sustainable and resilient communities. I would also just add, we pursued doing organics collection because the community asked for it. In 2016, the Alaska Master Gardeners came to us and said, we want more municipal composting programs. So that's one of the things that's driven us. And again, we are keeping everything local, and we're helping local composters in South Central Alaska to develop new business streams by being able to take that waste, create compost, and then they're able to either use it on their farms or to sell it.
Representative Tuck has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I appreciate the composting because there's a lot we can do with that. But when you mentioned the 25% to 30% flaring, what are the barriers in utilizing all that methane gas?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, we have been working with the base to try to expand that power project. We are working with the federal government, so it is quite a challenge to do that. So that's an ongoing conversation that we keep having. We're also in the process of looking at alternative uses for that gas. One thing we're looking at very seriously right now is a leachate evaporator. We produce a lot of leachate at the landfill. It's garbage water, essentially, but we do have to transport it and get it into the wastewater system. So if we can reduce our overall leachate, that's trucks off the road and less leachate that we have to put into the wastewater stream. So we are looking at that as other options.
By me, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So is it that we're producing more gas than the needs of the military bases? Is that what I'm hearing? Because you said they're working with the federal government. Or is there, I'm not understanding what that barrier is. Are we producing more and we just don't have a customer for it? Or is there other barrier there working with the federal government?
We're just producing too much at this point. Yeah, then what, there's only so many generators, so.
And if I may, Madam mm-hmm. Chair, I have gone to Waste Expo for the last 2 years and won't be able to make it this year. But there's a lot of innovative stuff going on re-outfitting garbage trucks and solid waste trucks and the transfer trucks into methane gas so that you can utilize it that way too. So just something for your consideration.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we'll just briefly go over how we have been doing this organics collection. At Solid Waste Services, we basically have three arms to our program. We have our curbside organics program, which is the residential curbside collection of organic material, community compost, which is a drop-off program, and then the work that we've been doing with the school district to also get their food waste and be able to use that for composting. So very briefly, this is what we're currently accepting in our residential programs. It's mostly fruit and veggie scraps, coffee grounds, eggshells, and compostable bags, as well as yard debris. So again, the leaves and the grass and the small twigs. We are not currently accepting compostable containers. Those require a higher level of processing, and we don't have that at the moment with all of the composters that we're working with. The style of composting that they're doing is a static pile or a windrow, so it's pretty minimal processing. And so as a result, we just aren't able to have these things break down during the composting process. We also don't accept any meat or bread and stuff like that. That's mostly a vector control issue. We want to make sure that we're providing a safe program to residents, and we don't want any animals or wildlife getting into the containers. So that stuff is ending up in people's trash. So I think one day we do eventually want to get it, but it does require a higher level of education for the community. And since this is still in the pilot stage, where we're slowly transitioning into that. So curbside organics, this is really our main program, the one that we've really focused on. It is the commingled collection of food scraps and yard trimmings. It's the pink cart program. So if you have been in parts of Anchorage on a Thursday or Friday, you may have seen a bunch of pink carts lined up in your neighborhood. That's our curbside organics program. It followed a yard waste pilot that we did in 2017, where we just collected yard debris, and then we started adding in the food scraps in 2018. It's been very popular. Right now we have 800 participants in the solid waste services area. That's the cap that we have this year due to some logistical concerns. Moving this material around can be quite difficult. And so we're still building up some infrastructure to help consolidate all the material and make it more efficient in its transport. So that's where we capped it at. We have a waiting list of 500 at the moment. Yeah, it's very, very popular. It's been really great. We also started working with Alaska Waste this year. In Anchorage, there's two solid waste services areas. If you live in our area, you have to have trash collection service outside of that boundary, which it comprises of 80% of the city. Alaska Waste is the largest trash hauler. They launched a small collection program as well using our model. So we were really proud that we were able to give them the information to be able to do that and to continue to expand this. We collected 271 tons of material. It's a drop in the bucket, really, when you think about all of the trash that we take in on a daily basis. However, in 2018, we collected 53 tons. So we really are expanding the program pretty dramatically. And again, we're looking at this year at least doubling this. Again, once we have some of that back-end infrastructure in place, it should be good. And then hopefully we can continue to exponentially size up the program. I'll also note we have a community compost program where there are two drop-off sites. Again, not everyone has access to curbside trash collection, and so we want to make sure that we're being equitable with our program and giving everyone the chance to participate and to recycle their food scraps. So we have two locations. The way it works is you take your food scraps at home, you collect them, you bring them to the site, you drop them off, and then that all gets composted. But while you're there, we actually provide finished compost for people to pick up so they can immediately put it back into their garden and start growing more food. It's the leave a bucket, take a bucket system. This year we distributed 143 yards of compost that went back into the community. I will say our tonnages were down a bit this year. Last year we were accepting yard debris in these drop-offs as well, and we stopped doing that this year because it's just too difficult to contain that in a small area. So as we move forward, we are looking at other options for yard debris because no one is coming and just dropping off a bucket of leaves. It's like a whole truckload. So we want to make sure that they have a place to recycle that when needed. And then lastly, we have been working with the Anchorage School District to capture the food scraps that they are creating. Andy here will talk a little bit more about all of the great work that they've been doing with tray system and waste reduction, but there is still food scraps that we're trying to get at. And so last year we had 10 schools participating. We partnered with Central Recycling Services. They are also our composter. We were collecting about a ton of material a week. This year we have scaled it. We're up to 11 schools, but we've included a high school and a middle school. There are some really interesting challenges there because we have to have a really clean product because we don't have a lot of processing with all of the organic material that we're collecting. And when you start expanding out to middle schools and high schools, you have to make sure the kids know what they're doing versus elementary schools where it's a much more contained lunch period. So we're working on that for this year, and it really gives us great insight into institution-level collection. That way we can start looking and expanding out to other hospitals, airports, that sort of thing, so we could start getting a more large-scale generation going. So. And I thank you very much for your time. Happy to answer.
Thank you so much for your presentation, and congratulations on all of the success. I am currently on the waiting list for a pink bucket myself, so I hope it gets expanded. Are there any questions for our presenter?
I'm just very impressed. It's impressive.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm excited to hear about all the work you're doing, and I appreciate you're also quantifying the fact that composting can help to reduce our carbon dioxide release into the air. I think that that's really important to understand how that fits in, and I think some members of the public are not clear how composting actually helps to contribute to a reduction in the production of greenhouse gases. But there's something that is not on the agenda for today that I want to ask you about, and that was with regard to recycling. It was my understanding that a few years back we had a program to test the recycling of glass for use in road maintenance. And do you know why it is that we don't do that anymore?
Yeah, through the chair. So, Representative, I'm not familiar with any testing. We're not currently using glass in road construction because there are federal requirements that maintain that only a small portion of the bedding material can be made of recycled glass. Mm-hmm. It's not cost effective to do that. We found that when we mix the recycled glass with gravel and stuff, it just doesn't pencil out for the recyclers that are making it. So mm-hmm. when we are using that recycled glass, we're looking for projects where the specification is 100% recycled glass use. Mm-hmm. So we've seen a lot of work in like pipe bedding and stuff mm-hmm. like that.
The economics of recycling in Alaska continue to challenge us, given that we don't have a big industrial, construction and maintenance. So I think I'm disappointed to hear that, but I'm not terribly surprised. Thanks.
And we're always looking at more uses for it. So and I think glass actually is a really great success story in Anchorage, actually, because a lot of other communities actually don't even have glass recycling. So we found that actually working within the municipality, especially with like Anchorage Water and Wastewater Utility, they have a lot of projects that need a lot of glass. And so even just having that outlet has been really, really successful in keeping the program going.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the presenter? Okay, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. Next, we have Andrew Mergens from Anchorage School District, and then we have one other presentation after that, so we're, I think, good on time, hopefully. That would be hilarious. Oh, I do have a presentation for this guy.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Andy Mergens, and I am the Senior Director for Student Nutrition at the Anchorage School District. And I appreciate the opportunity to kind of describe the fundamental change that we want to make in how we serve meals across the district. So you're going to see as I kind of go through this brief what we're looking at and what we're trying to do and what we're trying to accomplish. We really want to kind of to give everybody a little bit of perspective. The way ASD serves meals right now is kind of a TV dinner style. So particularly at the elementary school, to a lesser extent at the middle and high school level, if you are a student going through a lunch line at an elementary school, you're going to get your meal. And let's say, for example, if the meal is spaghetti and meat sauce with green beans, if that's the menu for the day, if you're a student in an elementary school, you're going to get a black plastic tray, a two-compartment tray that has spaghetti, meat sauce in one side and green beans in the other. And that meal is heated up served to you. You know, the kid goes through the line, and it's take it and go, take it and go, take it and go. And the kids are kind of hustled through the line. And what our intent is to kind of fundamentally change that 35-year-old methodology and go back to the way it was, certainly when I was in grade school and probably when a lot of you were in school too as well, that you would get a plastic tray. You would go through the line, and the lunch staff would serve up the spaghetti and the meat sauce and the green beans and the milk or whatever else it was. You'd take your meal back. You'd sit down. You'd eat it. And when you were done, you'd take the plastic tray back to the cafeteria, and they'd run it through the dishwasher, and it was literally a rinse and repeat factor. And that's what we're looking at doing, primarily because it gives us a lot of flexibility to introduce different menus. It gives us an opportunity to really increase the amount of a local grown products that we're introducing into the menu system. But it also obviously cuts down on a lot of things. Certainly we can do away with the packaging. We can do away with some of the other ancillary things that go along with it. And it cuts down on food waste. So we'll kind of go down the slide here. So if you look on the left-hand side of the slide, you'll see that's the way elementary schools are served their meals exclusively. And this happens to be from a cafeteria at the Service High School. Depending on what the meal is for the day, the middle and high schools may have to serve that particular menu item in the same manner that are served at elementary schools. If this were, for example, the spaghetti and meatballs or the spaghetti and meat sauce example, rather than served in the black plastic tray, they're going to get it on a paper tray. Whereas the elementary school kids get it already prepared in the two compartment tray that's reheated. At the middle and high school level, they get a larger package of spaghetti, noodles, and green beans that they would serve individually. But ideally, what we want to do is transition away from the disposable, one-time use plastic and paper tray and move back to the one that you see on the right-hand side. Obviously, you can see the difference. The one on the right is much more appealing. It looks like something you'd rather eat as opposed to the TV dinner that's on the left-hand side of the slide. So the transformation really gives us an opportunity to do a lot of things. It gives us some ability to change up some really different menus. It's the new service style that reduces waste, not only in the packaging, but in the amount of food that's prepared initially. So in the National School Lunch Program, in order to receive federal reimbursement for the meal, we have to offer five components. The student, when they go through the line, has to take three of those components, and of that three, one of them has to be either a fruit or a vegetable. So if you go back to the spaghetti and meat sauce example, if the menu is spaghetti, meat sauce, green beans, an apple, and a milk, the child has to take at least one of the three of those items. They can take the spaghetti, the meat sauce, but they have to take a fruit or a vegetable. In the old style of packaging, the spaghetti and meat sauce and the green beans are in the two-compartment tray. If the kid doesn't want the green beans, he's stuck taking the green beans anyway. So under the new service style, we can modify that so that not only can the kid have the opportunity to pick the green beans if they want them or not choose them if they don't, but it also allows the staff to reduce the amount that they have to prepare in the meantime, knowing that there's a certain percentage, based on historical data, there's a certain percentage that's not going to take the green beans. So they can reduce the total amount of green beans produced by that percentage. So they're not making that, and oh, by the way, that's not going into the trash. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of see down there in the middle of the slide, if we reduce the waste, we significantly reduce the amount of packaging that's going into the landfill. So about 18 tons just in paper. It's about 42 tons when you combine the paper and the plastic reusable trays. It cuts down on food costs. It cuts down on some labor issues. And the plastic trays, as you can see, we get a return on investment of about 4.5 months. It takes us, we spend about $14,000 a month at the Clark Middle School as an example. They're the largest per capita user of the paper trays in this example. Mm-hmm. So about $14,000 a month on paper trays at Clark Middle School alone. 4.5 months not using those, the paper trays, they run about 17 cents a piece, so you can see they add up pretty quickly. And the plastic reusable trays are paying for themselves in 4.5 months. And there's also a significant amount of reduction that's going into the landfill as well. So how does my evil genius plan work out here? We started the pilot program at Service High School last March. It went very well. We learned some valuable lessons. We've expanded that to 6 more middle and high schools this year. We're about to bring a 7th on at the end of this month at Romig Middle School. And then our goal is to replace the service style and change it exclusively to the reusable tray service at all the middle and high schools by the end of next year. Why did we choose the middle and high schools first? For the most part, their cafeterias are bigger. They've got the equipment needed to do it. They've got the staff, as opposed to the middle schools, which you can see on the slide, are much later down the path, simply because it's going to take, there are more of them, and it's going to take longer for them to be transformed. In some instances, the schools where the kitchens are at were built in the 80s and 90s, and they were built around the methodology using the heat and serve. So their kitchens are tiny. Some of the schools, the kitchens are less than half the size of this room, and being able to shoehorn more equipment into them is going to be problematic. So we're going to have to look at potentially timing that with when the school is going to go through a renovation, if there's a larger renovation project to go through to expand that, to change the kitchen, so that it's going to allow us to phase those kinds of pieces of equipment back into it and change the service style. So the stuff that's in on the right-hand side of the slide, the phase two and beyond, the stuff that's in the beige-colored box, that's our goal. It may be a little bit inspirational or aspirational, rather, to get it done by that time, but we're going to see what we can do to hopefully make that change. One of the things that really allows us with the service style change to implement is to increase the amount of ingredients and additives and things that we get from Alaska growers. Starting about 2 years ago, we started off with potatoes coming out of the Mat-Su Valley. We were able to take whole raw potatoes from farmers in Mat-Su, and you can see on the right-hand side of the slide is whole potatoes being turned into mashed potatoes. So we were able to take to replace the powdered dehydrated potatoes that we would buy from a vendor in the lower 48 and change that to fresh made mashed potatoes that's clean label. It's got potatoes, milk, butter, and salt, and that's all it's got. It's made in my central kitchen facility, and it actually turns out to be about 2 cents a serving cheaper than what it was when we were purchasing the dehydrated stuff. So potatoes were the first. We're working potatoes and carrots. We get a lot of those out of the Mat-Su. I get about 19 tons of potatoes from the Mat-Su every year. I get 18 tons of carrots. We've looked at expanding that to fresher vegetables like broccoli and things like that, which when they're in season are great. When they're not in season, then they're a little bit problematic to get out of the valley for obvious reasons. We introduced beef this year, so we get about 1,500 pounds of Alaskan-raised ground beef that go into various dishes into the school system this year, and we're looking to expand that. And we've also been working with the Alaska Flour Company in Delta Junction. They've been trying to develop, we've been trying to work through the pilot stage of an Alaska hardy wheat strain that we can potentially raise here and supplement and ideally replace the wheat that we get from farms in the lower 48 and convert it exclusively to Alaskan grown. So what are the challenges that we got? Obviously, I mean, I've described some of them. We got to get equipment. We got to change the infrastructure in the schools. There's some operational things. We've been doing this for 35 years. There are kitchen staff that don't know how to do this anymore. So we're going to have to retrain them on how to kind of go back to cooking the way they used to do it, back when I was a kid. And then the other thing is one of the reasons or one of the benefits that the heat and serve method has is it's fast. You can understand that if you're an 8-year-old and you're going up to the lunch line and the lunch lady says, do you want a lunch? And the kid says yes, and they deal them out a prepackaged meal, and the kid takes it and goes. As opposed to if you have a tray and you have an 8-year-old and he goes up to the lunch line and the cafeteria staff says, would you like spaghetti? And the kid says, yes. Do you like green beans? Yes. So if you multiply that by, 400 kids, all of a sudden the time starts to add up. And the already very narrow window that schools have to serve kids all of a sudden gets shorter. In my facility, I've got a lot of capacity to do a lot of things. I can bake a lot of my own things. You saw the pictures where we're making mashed potatoes and spaghetti sauce and all that. I can do a lot of that. But there's also some equipment that's going to have to get replaced. The assembly line conveyor belt systems that we use to make the prepackaged heat and serve trays are antiquated. They're really not good for anything else, so they're going to have to go away, and they're going to have to replace them with something that we have to figure out what we're going to do it with yet. And then from an increase in the amount of local produce that we get, obviously our partners in the community are going to have a big thing. There's a lot of capacity to grow a lot of things in the state of Alaska. They can grow a lot. We can eat a lot. One of the challenges that I'm sure everybody's aware of is that there's not a whole lot of people in the middle that can process it. So I'll use the example of green beans, for example. Green beans are ready, and they're about time to be picked about, the end of July-ish. What isn't happening in the end of July? School's not in session. So what do you do with, several tons worth of green beans that are ready to be served, but there's no one to eat them? Well, you can them, you freeze them, you process them in some way. We really don't have a good handle on that process yet. Could the growers in the state make enough green beans to potentially get me and all the other school districts and everybody else for that matter through a winter and through a growing season? They could if we could have a way to process them. And then the second side of that is, how do you store them? There isn't enough cold storage in the state to potentially put all those green beans or all that broccoli or all that whatever it may be. So that's another kind of an infrastructure kind of thing that we have to take a look at.
Thank you.
So, questions?
Representative Hopkins has a question.
Thank you. Thanks for the very intriguing presentation. Look forward to seeing how it goes so I can pressure Fairbanks into doing the same thing. You talked all about the lunch plans that you have. Do you have any plans for instituting this for breakfast as well in the future?
Yes, it would all be the same.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. So I have the privilege of being a high school teacher and working in this district for a long time, and the lunchroom transformation I've lived through at the lunch ladies, a renovated kitchen that could only do the package delivery. And as soon as we went back to the trays and a child required to still take at least 3 of the 5 offerings, by day 2 we figured out that making them take it and having them eat it were 2 different things. And so adjacent to the cashiers, by day 2 or 3 of us returning to lunchroom trays, was the things I don't want on my tray bin, which becomes the place that all the football players went to because, they could down 7 milks or 4 apples or 3 fruit cups. And, of course, kids who can't afford lunch might be there doing it. And so having as many of those, although we want to get to the tray as the serving surface, things that could be taken off of that and placed in the share bin is what they're called at each of the cashier stations. And I'm not sure if we are violating federal law by that, but I believe that they walked it out was they have to take it, but we don't have to allow them to immediately dump it. So moving the trash cans a long ways away, but having the share bin right there so they can stop and move it off their tray. So they fulfilled the federal reg, and we try and keep it out of the waste stream. I'm sure you've thought of that because you spend your day with food and kids.
Yeah, through the chair, we do, and there is a bit of a challenge. One of the things in changing the service style is as I mentioned, they have to take a fruit or a vegetable. Green beans don't lend themselves very well to go into the share table, but an apple does. So if a kid goes through and if they really don't want the green beans, under the new service style, they don't have to take them. But they would have to take an apple, and if they don't want the apple can go to the share table, and somebody else who may want an apple can take.
Any other questions? Well, I'm going to follow up. In the interest of time, I think we have to move on. But I'm very interested in this and very excited and specifically want to learn more about how the Alaska Product Preference Statute might allow you to purchase more Alaska-grown. We just, 1 or 2 years ago now, we changed that percentage and upped it to give a little more price flexibility. So I'll want to follow up with you because just the way we were characterizing that is like the anchor tenant, you know, if the Anchorage School District can sign up to buy huge amount of potatoes or carrots or whatever, then the farmers got all these opportunities to fill in with smaller sales, right, but, you know, have that stability. And so it's just, it's so exciting to see this push.
Yeah, and we really understand that is that, you know, I serve 25 to 30,000 meals every day when school's in session. So obviously, I'm the single largest server of food in the state on any given day. So that's obviously got a lot of purchasing power that, you know, if I sign up to buy potatoes, as an example, from the Mattsu Valley, and the Mattsu Valley School District does that, and the Fairbanks School District, you know, the top five school districts all do that, and then it kind of filters down to the smaller bush schools. If all of a sudden we're the ones who are really kind of sharing or bearing the brunt of keeping, you know, Farmer X's lights on and paying his staff, that's not a bad thing, because then all of a sudden, intuitively obvious, the Fred Meyers, the Cars, the farmers markets of the world, that's what makes him profitable, and that's what incidentally is going to drive the price down if they're growing more of it, and it, even to the point where it may be competitive with markets in the lower 48 where we can start exporting it. Mm-hmm. You know, I kind of mentioned this in the Lunch and Learn. And in some other venues as well, is there are actually cruise ship tours for primarily Chinese and Japanese tourists, where they will take them out to the Walmart in Wasilla where they can buy Alaskan grown carrots because they are so much sweeter and so much better than carrots that they can get wherever they get them. But they will take them out for the exclusive purpose of buying Alaskan-grown carrots. And that's kind of neat. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. Did you have a question?
I'd mostly just have a comment. I think I was, it seems it's common sense that we, allowing children the choice to pick their own foods, that we're going to waste less food and that could save us money. But I was really thrilled to hear that actually producing mashed potatoes made out of Alaskan potatoes, the ingredients of which we know, right, actually it was 2 cents less per serving, mm-hmm, per student, while we're supporting a budding agriculture industry in the state of Alaska. It improves our food security, you know, as we support those farmers. It seems like this is really big progress, and I'm really appreciative of all of your work on this front. I think that we all know that we need to move towards more real foods in our diet, and we need to have more food security in the state of Alaska, having more foods that we grow right here. And you're right, really on the cutting edge and pushing that and using the economic purchasing power of those 30 plus thousand people that you're feeding every day. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll look forward to updates as the progress continues. And then our last group for the presentations, we have Scott Muggeridge is going to come up, and he's the president of the Alaska Farm Bureau. Schultz is going to join us to talk about peonies. She's with AK Perfect Peony. And then Kelly Foreman with Kodiak Baptist Mission Goat Dairy. They are the newest grade A dairy to come online in the state of Alaska. Welcome. And I know the peony presentation has a lot of pictures. It's a little bit long, but like I say, I think we can go till about 3:10. And so just I'll try to let you guys get
stop at 3:10.
Yes. Let you get started on that. Can you help them get the presentation pulled up? We keep running over. We keep having that challenge. Thank you so much. And then when you are talking, if you don't mind, just saying your name for the recording secretary and affiliation.
Chairperson Tarr and members of the committee, thank you. And my name is Scott Muggeridge. I'm the president of the Alaska State Farm Bureau. I'm also a farmer. I live and reside in Delta Junction, Alaska, farm with my son and his family and my wife. I am the number one herd of cattle in the interior of Alaska. I raise I may be the nearest thing to a commercial production farm that you might ever see. If you ever, no offense to Representative Tallarico's deal through the chair, but we may be the second in demand highest thing is to take a tour of the Delta Farms. But I invite you all to do that sometime, and Representative Tallarico's been on that, Representative Tarr. And I invite you to do that, to see production agriculture as it exists. It really is. The potential for agriculture, what we're doing here, and the growth in it is phenomenal. In my opinion, there is no place in the United States for that potential except here. And I think we're going to be the breadbasket of the nation someday. I really do. I see that in the future. And I hope I live to watch my grandsons do it, not myself. I was going to tout a lot I was aimed to tout a little bit on the census reports, how much growth we've had, but some of the others have already leaned on those things, and I'm not one to ever write anything down. I speak off the cuff a lot, and watching these, watching your meeting today, I'd like to reflect on a couple of things that you did in your earlier meeting, and one was the fire prevention that I think that's important. That makes more sense than anything I've ever heard. Now, you're going to clear firebreak paths, and you're going to do that near and in close proximity to villages and people. What better source resource would be that land use in agriculture? And instead of maintaining that every so many years, if it's in agriculture, the farmer's maintaining it. You take that cost out of the budget, and you also, there's no better steward of the land than a farmer or a community organization that want to do a community garden nearby town or something like that, and you take away that constant flux of needing to work on that. I watch these power poles, where they go through every 10 years and cut all the trees down. If they just go a little bit further in that process and let us hay and graze that ground, they would never have to come back and do that again. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a way maybe to, it's something you might look into. And I certainly don't want to be a legislator. I'm just voicing a something I've seen. And I want to thank you as well, ARLF, for forwarding the amendment too. The ARLF is important and vital to Alaska's fragile little budding ag economy. A regular bank does not look at us. The ARLF, Farm Service Agency, federal government program, and the small program ARRC. That's the only lending institution we have, the only reach out for capital we really have. So ARLF is very important to us, probably the most flexible of all of those, and has the most resources in it. And you asked about the amount of money in it earlier. It's about half loaned out. It's about half being used now. So. And I may not be perfect on that 13 million number, but it is in that 13, 14 million and about half in loans. There's not enough farmers using it, but I applaud the BAC board for wanting to do outreach and get more people using it. And I get calls, being a Farm Bureau state president, I talk to someone out of state almost every week interested in moving their farm operation to Alaska. So it's a scary venture to move 3,500 miles across across Canada to get here and not know what's going on. So they talk to someone like me that's done. And my whole family just came. It was an easy process for me. Nothing scares me, and I'm into something new every day. But a lot of people just can't foresee that. But when I talk to someone outside, they don't realize what we can do agriculture wise and that's why I invite you to a project like Delta to just see what we can do. It looks like an Iowa farm ground around there. I've got 800 head of cattle, and they every one stand outdoors at 40 below, and we manage a very successful beef operation. We market beef from Homer to Fairbanks. And, you know, if you don't know where it's available, I'll let you know. But anyway, I don't want to take up a lot of your time. Like I said, a lot of things were mentioned already. I just appreciate being here. Any questions, I'd be happy to answer them and give you that invitation. And I'm going to turn my time over to these gals that have much better information.
Thank you. We really appreciate you being here today. Ms. Rita Joe.
Hi. I do have a lot of slides, but I'm really quick.
Okay, and if you don't mind, just stating your name for the record.
This, I'm Rita Jo Schultz, and I own Alaska Perfect Peony in Homer, actually Spritz Creek, along with my son. It's a family farm. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the peony industry and our relationship with the Division of Agriculture. This is one picture of our farm. This is the entire farm. We have about 25 acres here. We have high tunnels. We have ponds. We have creeks. We have four fields. We have processing. We have three coolers. But when I first started 14 years ago, nobody even knew how to spell peony. There was nobody that knew how many pounds of lime you needed in your, and et cetera, et cetera. Now, after 14 years, there are a lot of organizations that are supporting us. This slide just gives you a few of them, and I'll talk a little bit about some of them. The Alaska Grown is extremely important to them. As you all know, it's the second oldest state branded marketing program, and 92 Alaska Grown members are peony producers. There's about 200 farms right now. The Certified American Grown, of which I am the chairman of their council, so that's really dear to my heart, comprise over 56% of the USA cut flower growers belong to CAG. And we go every year, we go into the fly-in to Washington, D.C. This on the group you see here are all peony farmers from Alaska going to the White House for our annual fly-in. We have, and we're in Washington, that's coming up next week. We have, we do something with the Wine Institute there. We have receptions there, and we're very influential in that area. We do the First Ladies Luncheon every year. The next one's going to be May 12th, 2020. Now, Alaska peonies are famous. We're known now. Everybody knows all about us. We're featured on the Alaska on TV all the time. I've been fortunate enough to work with Senator Murkowski to do some of our weekly reports. I was invited to the White House for the Champions of Change. We do Field to Vase. Field to Vase is sponsored by the American Grown, Certified American Grown. And they have these events all over the United States. And it's $150, it used to be. Now it's $200 to attend. So it's very expensive. And we come to Alaska. They came to Alaska last year and again the 2 years before. And this is Beth Van Sant's place. I've been fortunate enough to be recognized by the Small Business Championship. And again, it was because of peonies and also with Nesbitt. And when President Obama came, who did they think of that they needed a bouquet for his room? It was Alaska peonies.
Very cool.
We're in a lot of magazines on the left-hand side there. Can you guys see this? Oh, okay. Okay. The left-hand side is Red Charm on our farm, and the right-hand side is that same Red Charm in the magazine. And Sunset Magazine's done a lot about Alaska peonies. Even Homer is now called this, officially is called the City of Peonies, and that's because we have peony flower gardens all up and down the street that we've put in over the past 5 years. So, the Society of American Florists, which is the main magazine, the main rag, Zashi for all of cut flower growers. This is Travis, the owner in the middle, and on the other side is another gal, Deborah Prinzing, who's also very famous in the industry. So a couple years ago, Senator Murkowski sponsored a bill. It wasn't a bill. What do you call it when it's not a bill?
Resolution.
Resolution. Thank you very much. It was for July to be the American Grown Flowers Month. Well, that was perfect for us because that's when our peonies are in bloom, you know, in July. So on the right-hand side, you see a picture of me standing in front of the headquarters for Safeway, the NorCal division, which is one of the largest divisions of Safeway in the United States. Their increases were 17% increase in sales. So, again, I'm just showing you some of the people that have been instrumental in helping us get going on this. This is a picture in our field. This is my son on the left, who's my partner, and one of our young kids that started working for us when she graduated from eighth grade. She's been with us 8 years now. But by far, the Division of Ag is the most effective one-on-one, hands-on supporter that we have for the peony industry. There's some of the people. Western United States, WUSADA is an organization that comprised of 13 of the Northwest states. Every one of them has a director, and Joanna's our director. And up until the last few years, even though it's a federal program, and I've been after them for 14 years, nothing was happening with the cut flower industry. And I'm going to tell you that Joanna got in there, and now things are happening with the cut flower industry, especially for Alaska. A little bit more about them. They do a lot of grant work for us. Some of the stuff is in your packet, so I'm not going to go over it for you. Phytosanitary permits, I do want to go over this for just a minute because we're getting more and more requests for selling to foreign countries, exporting. And in order to do that, most of these countries require a phytosanitary permit. And the only person that can do that for is someone from the Division of Agriculture. So again, we really appreciate your support for funding them. This, for instance, this is one where I was going to, I don't know if this is Hong Kong or Singapore or Indonesia or which one it was, but here I am going into the U.S. Department of Agriculture, sponsored by a WUSADA permit. This is in Vietnam, and I was so excited. I found peonies in the flower markets there and got to take a picture with some of the people there. But the cut flower industry is a huge industry. This picture is in Miami, and it's one of the greenhouses. Right now, I just got one of my feeds this morning told me that 600 million stems are coming in from Colombia for Valentine's Day. Can they come in through Miami? This is the Miami area here. I went down to their inspection station. I got to go back in there. These boxes all come in on cargo ships. And the blue curtain you see behind there is that's cooling systems, and all the boxes have holes in them, and they're being cooled down. We don't have any of that here. You know, we don't have any cooling stations. We're, you know, way, way beyond having that, but that is something that, you know, for the future. We don't have all of our shipments that go out of Alaska have ice packs in them, but they all go out no refrigeration whatsoever. So we are handicapped in that one way. And, you know, you've all seen this slide, I'm sure, before. 9.5 hours from 90% of the world, but if we don't have our phytosanitary permits, we won't be doing it. We won't be taking advantage of any of that. The state run has quite a few grant programs. I'm sure you've heard about the specialty crop grant program. That's extremely important for us. They've done 10 grants. The Division of Ag has done 10 grants for peonies already. This is one of the specialty crop grants. This is Dr. Gary Gastnager from the Western, from Washington State University, putting some data processing tools, information out into my fields so they can test for raindrops and this type of thing. Those are all part of the grants. And there's two or three going on right now that are three states, Hawaii, Washington, and Alaska. We're doing this one. It's called the THRIP program through this one right here. If you send your box of peonies to Vietnam and they open the box up and a little bug comes out, they're going to destroy that and your name's going to go up on the board, not the good board. So it's very important that we have help from our – and I just tell you one quick story. Some folks are shipping over to Vietnam now, and they – to get your phytosanitary permit, it's complicated, and I don't want to go into that. But they brought their boxes into Anchorage, and the Phytosanitary Division of Ag people came over and inspected it there rather than come to the farm, which is very expensive. And there was a bug. So for the next 4 hours, the growers went through every flower, checked every flower for bugs. At 3 o'clock in the morning, someone from the Division of Ag came back out to CAFE and inspected them again so they could go out. So they've just been extremely helpful for us. This is a little bit about fumigation. Won't go into that. They're helping us with finding some herbicides, things that are more likable. We do, in our fields, this is one of our fields, we have beekeepers come because there's a sooty mold that gets on the bottom of, because they're all honey, nectary things, you know, sweet things. And the bees are helping with that. That's a program we're working with. FSMIT's another program that they have for exporting. This is when we went to Hong Kong. This is my office manager. Never been out of the state of Alaska on the right-hand side. She had a great time. We get to go to some of the big shows, and once we go to a big show, when there's 15,000 people, you don't have to worry about marketing anymore. You've got your exposure. And the Division of Ag is working right now to help get into the PMA show in Dallas. There's 16 at least reality shows going on in Alaska right now, so there's no reason why we shouldn't be taking advantage of some of that for marketing. And our company, Alaska Perfect, does the weddings over on the glaciers. We have a relationship with the helicopter drivers, so I'm thinking that this should be the next reality show here. We've heard people talk about education coming and the tour groups and the cruise ships and that type thing, but tourism is a tremendous new budding thing for agriculture. This is 52 people came in from Kentucky, from the Farm Bureau in Kentucky, to visit our farm. And we really appreciate you passing Senate Bill 217 for the liability for us. You've already heard about the census, but I'm going to point out on this slide the main thing to look at is we had a 29.9% increase. And where the overall United States agriculture was down 3.2%, Alaska was up 29.9%. Oh, I wanted to show you that, though. But I'll just brag a little bit. You look and see where the most of it's coming from, and that will be the Kenai Peninsula. So we're working on some. Marketing is the biggest thing that new growers are having trouble with, because a lot of them are have never had any retail experience, so they don't have marketing skills. So that we're always working on. We're working on a marketing program right now. We do 8 grocery store chains. And this is for the newest one, and we're calling this Mini, M-I-N-I, Mini Possibilities. And the little box you see down there will be the smallest box that we've ever sent. So I think the little baby on there. But I'm going to put a note at the bottom that says, baby not included. This is out in our field, bringing them in. Just thought I'd show you a couple pretty pictures. This is our coolers, and all these are packed and ready to go. Lika's opening the big doors from the biggest cooler we have, and FedEx backs up into the door at 5 o'clock in the morning and heads off with our 80 boxes or whatever we have for the day. And this is the other end of the cooler where they're waiting to be processed. Some of the smaller farmers are making these little coolers, and they're delivering their peonies to larger farms to market for them. Grading is a big important thing. If we don't grade your peonies and you don't let your buyers know what they're really getting, you can get into big trouble and it can cause some problems.
The great photo.
If you are ever in the Homer area, Fritz Creek Garden area, I'd like to invite you to come hang out in the peony fields with me. And I'd also like to invite all of you to come tonight to the Governor's Mansion. It'll be all Alaska grown shish kebabs, rhubarb crisp. I just did that this afternoon. Wow. Got ice cream. I think it's birch syrup ice cream. Yeah, should be really good.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm sorry you had to go so quickly, but it was awesome and very exciting what you're doing.
I am your closer. My name is Kelly Foreman. I am from Kodiak Baptist Mission and Heritage Farm and Ranch, and we have the only grade A certified goat dairy currently in the state of Alaska. So I'm very excited to be able to be here. And I thought it would be a lot easier for you to see what it takes to become a dairy rather than me talk some more. I am so impressed with how you can all sit here. I never do this, and it's so hard for me to sit. So I want to just give you a snippet of my life the last couple of years. We appreciate greatly your support, and I think that amazing things are happening in agriculture in our state. They said, I'm going to let this talk.
Thank you. And I'll just say, because we're going to have to wrap up quickly as we're transitioning, a huge thank you to all of you that are here with the Food Security Week, the Food Policy Council, the school district, the individual farmers, the Farm Bureau, the food bank. I hope I didn't forget anyone, but you're all doing amazing things in Alaska, and we so appreciate having you in front of us today, so that we'll just say that so people will be able to run out quickly.
And I think we just need to acknowledge through the chair that Representative Stutes stuck her head in, because there can't be somebody from Kodiak in the building unless she's checked on him. And then she usually says, yay, Kodiak. So we've done it for her. And yeah, there you go.
Thank you.
All right, here you go. I won't talk anymore. You guys can enjoy a minute here.
day one, setting things up in the dairy. We have our awesome manual. Here we go. Got things hooked up. Now my job for the weekend is more homework. Anyway, gonna figure out all the things I don't even know that I don't even know. Temperatures for refrigerators morning and night, 7 days a week for the rest of my life, I think. Anyway, it's always crazy though when there's another month completely full. We've made it through another month of the dairy. Woo-hoo.
Your support. I know that the dairy has been an area of a lot of talk, and we will continue to work hard for Alaska. I look forward to all of the kids that will one day take my spot, and can't help, I'm a huge football fan, and at the beginning of the Super Bowl, all those kids ran in, you probably remember that, and they said, the next 100 years. And I'm so inspired by that in knowing that the decisions we make today will affect our next 100 years. And that's why we're doing what we're doing. So thank you all very much.
Thank you so much. Congratulations. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. And we have run over. It's 3:12 p.m. We will adjourn today's meeting. Thank you, Senator Begich. I know you're here for another meeting, but want to recognize you.